Welcome, everyone, and thank you for standing by. At this time, all participants will be on listen-only until the question-and-answer session of today's conference, at which time you may press star one to ask a question. Today's conference is being recorded. If you have any objections, please disconnect at this time. I'd now like to turn the meeting over to your host, Mr. William Kane. Sir, you may begin.
Thank you, Amber. Good afternoon. I'm Will Kane, and I'm representing the Clinician Outreach and Communication Activity, COCA, with the Emergency Risk Communications Branch at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. I'm delighted to welcome you to today's COCA call, Little Bite, Big Disease, Recognizing and Managing Tick-Borne Illnesses. You may participate in today's presentation by audio only, via webinar, or you may download the slides if you are unable to access the webinar. The PowerPoint slide set and the webinar link can be found on our COCA webpage at emergency.cdc.gov/COCA. Click on May 24th COCA call. The slide set is located under call materials. Free continuing education is offered for this COCA call. Instruction on how to earn continuing education will be provided at the end of the call. CDC, our planners, presenters, and their spouses and partners wish to disclose that they have no financial interests or other relationships with the manufacturers of commercial products, suppliers of commercial services, or commercial supporters. Planners have reviewed content to ensure there is no bias. This presentation will not include any discussion of unlabeled use of a product or products under investigational use. At the end of the presentation, you will have the opportunity to ask the presenters questions. On the phone, dialing star 1 will put you in the queue for questions. You may submit questions to the webinar system at any time during the presentation by selecting the Q&A tab at the top of the webinar screen and typing in your question. Questions are limited to clinicians who would like information on preventing, recognizing, and managing tick-borne illnesses. For those who have media questions, please contact CDC Media Relations at 404-639-3286 or send an email to media@cdc.gov. If you are a patient, please refer your questions to your health care provider. At the conclusions of today's session, the participant will be able to review the geographic distribution, define the symptoms of, identify the serologic tests and used to diagnose, and describe the appropriate use of antibiotics for Lyme disease, southern tick-associated rash illness, STARI, Rocky Mountain spotted fever, Ehrlichiosis, anaplasmosis, and other emerging tick-borne diseases. Our first presenter is Christina Nelson, MD, MPH. As a medical epidemiologist at CDC since 2012, she is a subject matter expert in various bacterial vector-borne diseases, including Lyme disease. She conducts epidemiological research on Lyme disease, assists with case follow-up and surveillance activities, and responds to inquiries from the public and healthcare providers related to this disease. She is also the author and first author and co-author of several Lyme disease publications. Our second presenter is Elizabeth Schiffman, MPH. Elizabeth is a senior epidemiologist with the Vector-Borne Disease Program at the Minnesota Department of Health. Her primary tasks involve coordinating human disease surveillance activities for tick-borne and mosquito-borne diseases in Minnesota, as well as working on a variety of studies and special projects regarding the ecology and epidemiology of vector-borne diseases in the upper Midwest. She has been a co-author on several peer-reviewed publications on mosquito and tick-borne diseases, most recently on Borrelia meyonii. Our third speaker today is Naomi Drexler, MPH. Naomi is currently serves as an epidemiologist with the rickettsial zoonosis branch at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. In that capacity, she compiles and analyzes national surveillance and other epidemiological data relating to tick-borne rickettsial diseases in the United States. As a subject matter expert, she has published materials in peer-reviewed literature on the epidemiology, prevention, and control of spotted fever rickettsiosis and other tick-borne rickettsiosis in the United States. At this time, please welcome Dr. Christina Nelson.
Hi, thank you, Will. Hello, thanks to everyone for attending, and thank you also to the COCA staff for organizing this call. I wanted to start off with a list of the most commonly reported tick-borne diseases in the United States. Today we will be discussing all of these except for babesiosis and also some newly emerging tick-borne diseases of interest. I wanted to point out also on this slide for information on these and other diseases, you can go to this website highlighted at the bottom, cdc.gov/ticks, which has a lot of information about the ticks, the diseases they transmit, and also maps of where they can be found. So different ticks transmit different diseases, as you can see. So shown here are some of the key tick vectors found in the United States. The black-legged tick, which is here on the top, as you can see, transmits a number of pathogens. I've just listed some of the ones it can transmit. A good mnemonic to remember for the three most common pathogens it can transmit or diseases that these pathogens can cause is LAB, Lyme disease, anaplasmosis, and babesiosis. Again, it can transmit more, but the most common are these three, and that's a good way to remember it. Also here you can see the Lone Star tick, which is an aggressive human biter and also transmits a variety of pathogens and causes different diseases, and also the dog tick. Here's a map of the most common tick-borne diseases that occur in the United States. So the diseases that are transmitted or the pathogens that are transmitted by the black-legged tick are concentrated heavily in the Northeast and the upper Midwest, as you can see here. So the purple, green, and orange, again, are those diseases LAB, Lyme disease, anaplasmosis, and babesiosis. You can also see for Rocky Mountain spotted fever and ehrlichiosis, the red and blue dots, those diseases primarily occur in the central and southern states. So it's very geography dependent where these diseases can occur. So Lyme disease, as many of you know, is caused by the spirochete Borrelia burgdorferi and also the newly discovered Borrelia meyonii, which our next speaker, Elizabeth Schiffman, will be discussing. It occurs in areas of North America, Europe, and Asia. There are about 30,000 cases reported annually in the United States, but based on a couple of studies that CDC has done, we estimate that actually there are probably about 300,000 infections that occur annually in the United States. And again, it's transmitted in the U.S. by black-legged ticks. The black-legged tick or deer tick in the Northeast and upper Midwest in the United States, and the western black-legged tick in California and parts of Oregon and Washington. Here's a map specifically of reported Lyme disease cases. So again, you can see they are concentrated in the Northeast and the upper Midwest. I did want to explain that diseases are reported to CDC by the county of residence. So this can cause some confusion, for example, when people see dots here in other places where there's not known to be a high incidence of Lyme disease or a high risk for contracting Lyme disease. So one example is if a child from Texas goes to visit his grandparents in Pennsylvania for the summer and contracts Lyme disease there, even if he's diagnosed and treated in Pennsylvania, he will still be reported as a case from Texas because that's his county of residence. So that's important to remember and kind of helps understand why there are dots in areas that may not be considered high risk for Lyme disease. The hallmark of early Lyme disease is the erythema migrans rash. It occurs in 70 to 80% of cases and usually appears about 1 to 2 weeks after the tick bite, but there is a range. It can range from 3 to 30 days. It expands gradually over several days, and it's rarely painful. And there are some key features that can help distinguish this from an allergic reaction, which, of course, is important to distinguish for treatment ramifications. Allergic reactions typically appear sooner, within the first 24 hours, and this is an allergy to the tick bite or the tick saliva. They're usually very itchy, and they're usually smaller, less than 2 inches in diameter. Whereas the erythema migrans rash, as you can see on this slide, it expands gradually. It often has a bullseye appearance, not always, and it's usually not particularly itchy, and it's usually larger than two inches in diameter. So it's important to note that erythema migrans, while the hallmark is a bullseye appearance, that doesn't always occur and can cause some confusion among providers. So here you can see this EM rash has a very homogeneous appearance. The one in the middle here has a triangular shape. And here you can see multiple EM rashes on the right that also have a homogeneous appearance. EM rash can also be bluish in color. It can have central vesiculation or ulceration. So it's important to have a high index of suspicion for Lyme disease, even when the rash doesn't look exactly like a bullseye that one would expect. So if left untreated, the bacteria can disseminate to other parts of the body. The bacteria is tropic to nerve, joint, and cardiac tissue, so it can cause infections in these locations. So it can cause facial palsy, meningitis, arthritis, carditis, and also late-stage neurologic effects such as peripheral neuropathy. I wanted to mention briefly the standard recommended testing for Lyme disease. So serologic testing for Lyme disease follows a two-step process. So the first test is usually an enzyme immunoassay that, if positive or equivocal, should be followed up by a Western blot. If patients have had signs or symptoms for less than a month, then the Western blot should be interpreted for both the IgM and IgG aspects of the Western blot. If a patient has had signs or symptoms for more than 30 days, then the IgG Western blot is sufficient for diagnosis. It's important to follow the two-step process and not go straight to the Western blot. The two-step process was decided upon by experts as the best balance of sensitivity and specificity. So following this process helps follow the recommendations and helps get the most accurate results possible. So because it's a serologic test, you're looking for an immune response to the infection. So that takes time for the body to develop. And so as with other serologic tests that are used for HIV and hepatitis and other things, there's a window period during which there's early infection, the body's immune response is still developing, and the sensitivity is actually low. So as you can see here, the sensitivity, again, is low during early infection when the EM rash or other manifestations may be there. But then during later infection, once the bacteria has disseminated and the body's immune response is really mounting, the sensitivity is actually quite good. Sometimes people may say, you may hear that the test misses 50% of cases or other quotes, but unfortunately that is an oversimplification. It's really lumping all of these together without understanding the nuance of the window period and sensitivity during early versus late infection. So the bottom line for this test, the sensitivity is good in later stages of the disease, and testing of patients in this early stage, if they have an erythema migrans rash and history of exposure in an area that is endemic or high incidence for Lyme disease, in these cases, testing is generally not necessary. It is absolutely appropriate to diagnose and treat these patients based on clinical presentation. The patients with later manifestations, such as facial palsy or arthritis or other manifestations, these are more nonspecific, and so the diagnosis really should be supported by testing as well. CDC and others are trying to develop tests that have a higher sensitivity in early disease, which would be helpful as an adjunct. So just a brief cautionary note, some labs offer additional tests that have not been clinically validated. Here's just a list of some of these tests, and these tests have, like I said, have not been clinically validated, and they are not recommended, and unfortunately, they can be very misleading to patients. Because of this issue, a couple of years ago, we put out a publication warning about these tests and also explaining the difference between CLIA certification and FDA clearance for tests. Most of these labs, if a lab offers a clinical test, they must be CLIA approved, which evaluates the laboratory and various aspects and is important for clinical laboratories, but is necessary but not sufficient for proving that a test is clinically accurate and clinically validated. They look at the lab, but they don't actually look at the individual tests and the clinical validation and the evidence behind the test. So this is a good resource for explaining to others. We kind of go through CLIA certification versus FDA clearance and what tests, where to find more information, and some tests that should not be used. The prognosis for Lyme disease, most patients treated with antibiotics recover completely, although it can take some time. Patients can be fatigued and have other symptoms, perhaps joint pain, for quite some time before they feel back to normal. In patients with persistent or recurrent joint swelling, retreatment with a second four-week course may be needed, and that is recommended. Some patients, particularly those with later stages of disease, may have persistent symptoms of fatigue, muscle aches, reduced concentration. If those symptoms last for more than 6 months, the preferred term is post-treatment Lyme disease syndrome. There have been a number of placebo-controlled trials that have not shown a sustained benefit of extended antibiotic treatment in these cases. Another study from Europe was recently published that looked at this again and still found no sustained benefit. And, of course, there are definite risks to prolonged antibiotic treatment, so at this point it's not recommended. I wanted to mention prevention of Lyme disease, which, of course, is very important. Avoiding tick habitat. So, of course, we want people to get out there and enjoy the outdoors, but if people can try to walk in the center of trails away from the brush where the ticks will be questing, that's helpful to avoid getting bitten by a tick. Using DEET and wearing permethrin-treated clothing are also very important. These are both very effective repellents, and the permethrin treatment for clothing is a great option because it lasts multiple washes, and people can have a dedicated, for example, pair of pants that they wear when they're hiking or gardening that they can know that it has been impregnated with a repellent, which can be really helpful. After being outdoors, I wanted to highlight this new finding that we just published a study on this. Tumbling clothes in the dryer on high heat for 5 to 10 minutes can kill black-legged ticks that are on the clothing. So CDC used to recommend tumbling clothes for 1 hour on a high heat, but that was based on one study that washed the clothes and then put them in the dryer for an hour and found that all the ticks died after that. But we had some anecdotal evidence that actually if you put dry clothes in the dryer, it takes much less time to kill the ticks. So we arranged to do some studies on this for black-legged ticks and found that within 6 minutes, all of the ticks can be killed when you put dry clothes in the dryer. So we are now recommending this. This was only studied for black-legged ticks, so to be on the safe side, we are actually recommending 10 minutes on high heat because Lone Star ticks and others may be more resistant to the heat. But we think this can be an easily implemented and effective way for people to kill those ticks that are on the clothes and also help them remember to get their clothes off and do a tick check and also shower within 2 hours of being outdoors. I wanted to mention briefly also antibiotic prophylaxis. There is some confusion about this. So a single dose of doxycycline to prevent Lyme disease is indicated when all of the following conditions are met. If it's a highly endemic area, the tick is identified as a black-legged tick. It's been attached for at least 36 hours based on the history of when the person likely acquired the tick or whether it's engorged. Prophylaxis can be started within 72 hours of removing the tick, and of course the doxycycline treatment is not contraindicated. The dose is 200 milligrams once for adults. There is some confusion about the duration, but again, it is one single dose of 200 milligrams, and this prophylaxis is only for Lyme disease. For other diseases, it either hasn't been studied extensively, or there is some indication that it may either mask the symptoms or just delay the symptoms, so it's only for prevention of Lyme disease. So lastly, I wanted to mention a couple of emerging tick-borne diseases. First of all, STARI, Southern Tick-Associated Rash Illness, causes a rash that is actually indistinguishable from the erythema migrans that's caused by Lyme disease. It can be accompanied by constitutional symptoms such as fatigue, headache, fever, muscle and joint pains, and this occurs actually after the bite of a different tick, the Lone Star tick. It's also known as Master's disease, and the cause is actually unknown. There have been many studies looking for viruses, bacteria, other pathogens, infectious pathogens that can cause this, and none have actually been found. So the current thinking is that it's possibly some sort of immune reaction or something else going on after that bite. Historically, it occurs in the southern U.S., but the range is expanding northward. You can see here in this map the range of the Lone Star tick, and so it can cause some confusion because especially in areas of Middle America and the Atlantic states, where both in the Northeast, where both this tick and the black-legged tick occur, people can come in with bullseye rash, and it's hard to determine whether it's STARI or Lyme disease. So for treatment, it's not known whether antibiotic treatment is necessary or beneficial. Like I said, no pathogen has been identified, so antibiotics are most likely unnecessary. And STARI has not been linked to long-term sequelae. Nevertheless, because STARI resembles early Lyme disease, physicians often treat patients with oral antibiotics. And in places where Lyme disease, there's a high incidence of Lyme disease, this is appropriate if the physicians or other clinicians choose to do this. We don't take a hard stance on it, but a good reference here is actually an analysis that Paul Antos and some other researchers did of a risk-benefit analysis where Lyme disease is rare. They found that observation is most likely the best strategy. So if you'd like more information on that, please refer to this paper and other information from our website. So lastly, I wanted to mention Borrelia miyamotoi. This is a relapsing fever spirochete. It was first identified in Japan, hence the name. It was named after a scientist who helped identify it. It was first detected in ticks in the United States and Connecticut in 2001, and the first report of human infections related to this was from Russia in 2011. They had a series of 46 patients with flu-like illness who were PCR positive for this pathogen. The first report of human infection in the U.S. was in 2013, and until recently, we only had case reports and small case series about this. And entomologic studies have shown that about 2%, but up to 10.5% of black-legged ticks in the U.S. can carry this pathogen. I wanted to mention a study that was published fairly recently by Malloy et al. I won't go into the details, but they tested a large number of samples from patients with flu-like illness for this pathogen, and they found 97 patients who are positive for it and described clinical data on 51 patients for whom they could get information on. So the bottom line for this study, and again, feel free to go find it and look it up if you want more information. It had a lot of very good information in it. One of the bottom lines is that the patients, many of them had very severe illness. They often seemed very sick, were often described as toxic or even septic appearing, and many had severe headaches, so much so that they were evaluated for meningitis or other central nervous system infections. Another important point that came from this is that some of the patients reacted on Lyme disease serology, but not all of them. And they were tested by PCR for a particular gene called the GLYPQ gene, that's G-L-Y-P-Q, and that they also did serology for GLYPQ. The PCR for GLYPQ appeared to be much better than the serology, and some companies do offer that test. So if you're worried about Borrelia miyamotoi, PCR for it, and particularly for that GLYPQ gene, would be the best way to diagnose these patients. But there's still a lot of research that needs to be done and still a lot that we're learning about. So next I will pass to Elizabeth Schiffman. Thank you all again very much.
All right. Thanks, Christina. So I'm going to be talking to everybody today about Borrelia mayonii, which is an emerging tick-borne pathogen. And so as we've already talked about, Lyme disease is a disease that's caused by bacteria that are part of the Borrelia burgdorferi sensu lato species complex. And so in the United States, this means, you know, that Lyme disease is caused by Borrelia burgdorferi sensu stricto. And in Europe, it is Borrelia afzelii, Borrelia greenii, and also Borrelia burgdorferi. And it's important to note that this species complex does not include the relapsing fever group of Borrelia, so Borrelia miyamotoi, as Christina was just talking about, or the more well-known also Borrelia hermsii, they're in a different grouping of Borrelia. And so we've already touched on this as well, but Lyme disease diagnosis is based on clinical presentation, particularly in cases when patients have that characteristic EM rash, as well as a history of exposure to black-legged ticks in an area where Lyme disease is endemic. Serologic testing can be used to help support this diagnosis, and as was mentioned, a two-tiered approach is what's recommended. Serology is not necessary for diagnosing early Lyme disease if people do have that characteristic EM rash, but it is really important in diagnosing disseminated infections or illnesses in people without that characteristic rash. The other test that is available for Lyme disease is a PCR test, and there are commercial assays that are available that can test blood cerebrospinal fluid, synovial fluid, and tissue. But it is considered to be more of an adjunct test rather than one that's used for routine diagnostics. As with any PCR test, it has the advantage of being able to directly detect bacteria in a patient with acute illness. You don't need to wait for the antibody response the way you do when you're relying on serology. But the major disadvantage of this test for Lyme disease is that it's not very sensitive. Blood is only positive in about 50% of patients who have acute illness with an EM, and CSF is only positive in about a third of patients who have early neurologic signs of Lyme disease. So our story of Borrelia meionii starts in June 2013 with a 10-year-old male patient from northwestern Minnesota, and he presented with fever, headache, neck pain, myalgia, nausea, vomiting, and a diffuse rash that was not a typical EM rash. But he's from an area of Minnesota where tick-borne diseases are endemic, and he had spent the week prior to his illness in northwestern Wisconsin, which is also an endemic area for tick-borne diseases. And so the providers, you know, given his symptom presentation, were highly suspicious for tick-borne diseases. He was pretty sick, though. He was hospitalized for 4 days, but was treated with kind of standard Lyme disease drugs recommended for treatment of Lyme disease, so ceftriaxone and then a course of amoxicillin, and he did recover completely. And so these pictures just show his rash. They're a little hard to see, but you can definitely tell that these are not your typical EM rashes. These pictures look really different from the pictures that Christina presented in her earlier presentation. And so a PCR test was ordered for this patient along with serology, and the results were a little bit interesting. So the peak that you see there, this is a melting temperature analysis of sample, and the peak for that is labeled as peak A is what you would expect if the patient was infected with Borrelia affidelii. The C peak is what you would see in Borrelia burgdorferi sensu stricto, and then this patient's blood had a melting temperature peak that was that labeled as B, which is different. It doesn't fit in with what you would expect to see based on known species. And this unique pattern was also seen in a few other cases. So there were a few other PCR whole blood samples that were positive with this same abnormal melting temperature pattern. One was an 11-year-old male from Wisconsin that was identified in July of 2013. A retrospective review of samples at Mayo also identified a 65-year-old male who was from North Dakota but had been exposed in Minnesota from the previous year, from 2012. And then there was also a synovial fluid specimen that had this same pattern that was from Mayo Clinic Eau Claire in Wisconsin, and that was a 21-year-old woman, and that one was also identified in June of 2013. And then in 2014, two additional cases had this same unusual melting temperature pattern. So this, of course, prompted some further analysis. So some sequencing analysis was done of one of the genes from those blood samples, the OPA1 gene. And you can see here that all the patient samples and then a few tick samples are included in this that were tested as well, but they all clustered together, and you can clearly see that they are not clustered with other known Borrelia species. So it was further evidence that maybe this was something that was different than what we had seen before. And so some of the specimens were able to be analyzed using dark field microscopy and culture. And so specimens were sent to CDC, and you can see by the red arrow on the picture on the left there that they were actually able to visualize a spirochete in a whole blood specimen, which is pretty unusual because Lyme disease, one of the kind of characteristic things about it is that people only have spirochetes circulating in their system for a pretty short time. And then the photo on the right is actually spirochetes that were cultured from one of the blood samples, which is also an interesting thing because Borrelia is notoriously difficult to culture. So some further phylogenetic analysis was done, and I'm going to skip to the next slide to talk about it and come back to this one. So they did a multi-locus sequence analysis that looked at eight housekeeping genes, and it's a technique that's been used before for defining genospecies in this Borrelia burgdorferi sensu latu complex. And the highest similarity of these patient specimens was to Borrelia burgdorferi, but it was only about 95% similar, which did not meet the threshold for it being just kind of a weird sample, but still Borrelia burgdorferi. It was enough for the researchers at Mayo and people at CDC to conclude that this was, in fact, a novel genospecies, and the proposed name for this organism is Borrelia mayonii. And so if we go back to the phylogenetic tree, you can see the red box on the top shows kind of all the Borrelia burgdorferi clustering together, and then the blue box a little further down is where you can see the patient specimens from this novel species. So it's pretty clear when you look at that phylogenetic tree that we're looking at something that's different from Borrelia burgdorferi. So obviously there was some question as to maybe whether some specimens had been missed in the past that were also could also be positive for this novel agent. So Mayo Clinic went back and looked at specimens from going all the way back to 2003 through September of 2014, and they analyzed about 100,000 specimens. And what was kind of interesting is they found that, none of the specimens from 2011 or from prior to 2012, none of those specimens were positive for Borrelia mayonii. But they did find positive specimens in kind of the more recent ones collected from January 2012 to September 2014. And what was even more interesting is Mayo Clinic gets specimens from all patients from all around the United States, although they're located in Minnesota. And so when they looked at specimens from 44 states that were not Minnesota, Wisconsin, or North Dakota, they once again found no positives. The only positives that they found were from patients who were residents of Minnesota, Wisconsin, or North Dakota. And so clinically, what did these patients look like? So it's important to remember that we're dealing with a really small N here of only 6 patients. So, what we find initially may not be what holds true in the longer term if we start to see large numbers of patients with Lyme disease caused by this bacteria. But at least in these 6 patients, we had a wide range of ages ranging from 10 to 67. 4 of them were male, 2 of them were female. 2 patients had a known tick bite, but everybody reported exposure to either ticks or tick habitat in Minnesota or Wisconsin. And this isn't strange. It isn't uncommon to have patients who have tick-borne diseases but never remember getting a tick bite. That's a pretty common thing. 5 of the 6 patients presented with an acute febrile illness, and 3 of them had potential neurologic involvement, although neither one had meningitis or encephalitis or really severe neurologic outcomes. There were some patients reported confused speech, profound somnolence, and some visual difficulties in one patient. 4 of them did present with a rash, but only one of those rashes was suggestive of what you'd think of when you would think of a traditional EM rash. And 1 patient did present with arthralgia rather than that acute febrile presentation. And so outcome-wise, 2 of those 6 patients were hospitalized, which is kind of interesting. Most patients who get infected with Lyme disease do not require hospitalization. All of these patients were treated with antibiotics that are recommended for treatment of Lyme disease, and 5 of the patients recovered completely, although 1 did report residual joint pain. So this map just kind of shows you where patients were exposed and their residence. It's a little hard to see on this graphic, but the triangles indicate locations of possible exposure, and then the circles are locations of their county of residence has a circle. But the map it's overlaid on is kind of a broader tick-borne disease risk map that's based on incidence of tick-borne disease. So that darkest red area are parts of Minnesota and Wisconsin that would be considered highest risk for tick-borne infections, and then the lighter colors are lower risk. So most of the patients that ended up with Borrelia mayonii did have routine serologic testing ordered for them, 5 of the 6 patients, actually. And most of the specimens did test positive by the EIA test in particular, although if you look at the 2 columns for the different EIA assays, you can see some differences. It seems that the C6 assay performed a little bit better in these patients than did the whole cell assay. And when you look at the Western blot results, that becomes a little less clear. Some of the patient specimens, you know, met criteria for positivity for the IgM, some of them for IgG, and but none of them actually were positive on both IgM and IgG. But what this does tell us is it indicates that there is some cross-reactivity on the conventional assays between these species of bacteria. So what about the ticks? We always want to know more about what is going on with the ticks. And we suspected that the likely vector of this would be Ixodes scapularis, or the black-legged tick, since that's the vector of most of our endemic diseases here in the upper Midwest. And so ticks were collected from 2 sites in Wisconsin and 4 sites in Minnesota, and then PCR testing was performed on those ticks that looked for both Borrelia burgdorferi and Borrelia mayonii. So the ticks from Wisconsin were tested at the Mayo Clinic Laboratories, and the ticks from Minnesota were tested here at our health department's public health lab. And so what we found, you can see the Minnesota ticks, tick results are on the top line, the Wisconsin ticks are on the second line. Borrelia mayonii results are in kind of the middle columns, and then burgdorferi results are in the rightmost columns. And what you can see is that overall more ticks were positive for Borrelia burgdorferi than Borrelia mayonii, which isn't surprising since we're probably dealing with something that's more recently emerged. And that infection prevalence was higher in adult ticks than in nymphal ticks, which is also not surprising. It's typically what we see. Adult ticks have had, you know, another opportunity to take a blood meal and acquire pathogens than nymphs have. And so these results are pretty consistent with what we would expect. And so Borrelia mayonii does seem to have some unique features, although, as I've said, we're dealing with a pretty small N here. But this disease so far has only been identified in patients from the upper Midwest, so either patients who are residents of Minnesota or Wisconsin or who were exposed in Minnesota and Wisconsin. And it wasn't detected in, you know, nearly 25,000 blood samples from other parts of the United States. Based on these initial findings, it seems that the disease is more severe when it's caused by Borrelia mayonii than by Borrelia burgdorferi. The rashes are also different. They tend to be more diffuse than that classic EM presentation. And the other interesting thing is that this organism has been found primarily in whole blood, which is traditionally not a great way to look for Borrelia burgdorferi. So in conclusion, I think there's still a lot we have to learn about this new species of Borrelia, and it's really unclear at this point how common of a cause of Lyme disease it really is. But research does indicate that it recently emerged. Like I said, they looked at blood specimens from before 2012 and didn't find any positives. All the positives have come since 2012. Both Minnesota and Wisconsin are considered to be high-incident states for Lyme disease and have several endemic tick-borne diseases aside from Lyme disease. And the risk for these diseases is highly seasonal here. The highest risk time of year is late spring through midsummer. And so tick-borne diseases, including Borrelia mayonii, should probably be in the differential in patients who present with febrile illnesses after being exposed to the outdoors in the upper Midwest. And I'd just like to acknowledge all of the other people who worked on this research and made this discovery possible. And with that, I will turn it over to Naomi.
Thank you, Elizabeth. So I'm going to be discussing some of the other tick-borne diseases today, including tick-borne rickettsial diseases such as Rocky Mountain spotted fever, ehrlichiosis, anaplasmosis, and other emerging tick-borne rickettsiae. So I'm going to start off with probably the most well-known rickettsiosis in the United States, Rocky Mountain spotted fever, which is caused by the bacterium Rickettsia rickettsii and is a member of the spotted fever group of Rickettsia. This is the most pathogenic of the spotted fever group rickettsioses in the United States. In the U.S., it's transmitted primarily by Dermacentor variabilis. In the Rocky Mountain region can also be transmitted by Dermacentor andersoni, and some parts of the U.S., including Arizona, has recently been reported to be transmitted by Rhipicephalus sanguineus, which is the brown dog tick. This organism infects and destroys endothelial cells and can cause widespread vasculitis, leading to more multi-system organ failure, and if left untreated, can be highly fatal, with 20
20% case fatality rate in untreated cases. So I'm going to skip over the distribution maps in the interest of time so we can have time to discuss some of the questions. But as you can see, the majority of spotted fever rickettsiosis cases are being reported out of the central United States, with 60% of the cases reported out of Oklahoma, Arkansas, Tennessee, Missouri, and North Carolina. But spotted fever rickettsioses are reported from across the contiguous United States. So I usually like to describe Rocky Mountain spotted fever clinical manifestations in three stages: the early, the moderate, and the late. Early illness is typically day one or two of illness, and typically patients are presenting with fever, headache, which may be severe, and myalgia. Around day two to four, we start to see the additional onset of more systemic symptoms, including respiratory symptoms, gastrointestinal, and you may see the occurrence of a slight rash at this time. It's important to note that most patients do seek care within the first 2 to 3 days of symptoms, meaning that they're presenting for clinical care at this time when you're seeing nothing but nonspecific symptoms. Nothing here screams Rocky Mountain spotted fever and is going to give you a red flag to know to treat presumptively. And for this reason, Rocky Mountain spotted fever is misdiagnosed in about 60 to 85% of patients in their first presentation. So the initial rash of Rocky Mountain spotted fever, the spotted part of Rocky Mountain spotted fever, comes from the rash that starts to be presented around day three of illness, or day two to four of illness. And the early manifestations of rash are typically, as you can see in these images, macular or maculopapular, blanching, and this usually appears, as I said, 2 to 4 days after onset of fever. The rash typically starts on the ankles or the forearms and spreads centrally to the body. It's important to note that the rash can be atypical, evanescent, or absent altogether, and that's really important to keep in mind. So late-stage manifestations of Rocky Mountain spotted fever really occur on day five or later, and include worsening systemic illness. As this disease advances, there's going to be increased amounts of vascular damage throughout the body, and as the bacteria continues unabated, this can be irreversible. And death typically occurs after day five. Laboratory abnormalities may also begin to occur at this time or become more prominent. This will include thrombocytopenia, hyponatremia, and elevated liver enzymes. Also on day five or later is when you start to see the classic Rocky Mountain spotted fever rash. So this is the petechiae that are present on the palms of the hands and the soles of the feet. And the petechial rash is really representative of the microhemorrhages in the dermis. So as you see those vessels rupturing in the dermis as presented by a petechial rash, you know that this is what's going on in other organ systems throughout the body. And this is really a late stage of manifestation that we work to prevent. We want to make sure that antibiotic therapy is initiated before these manifestations are shown. Please excuse the graphic nature of this image, but this just underlines the point of the diffuse nature of the vascular damage that can happen in late-stage Rocky Mountain spotted fever. It can manifest as respiratory distress, cutaneous necrosis, meningoencephalitis, and other cerebral edema, other manifestations that are very prominent. And these are often preceding death and even in patients where they are able to survive this disease, they may have long-term and permanent sequelae resulting from this vasculitis, this damage that's done. We know that children have had permanent cognitive deficits. We know that there's blindness, hearing loss, brain damage, and these may be irreversible. Some of the risk factors that are associated with fatal outcome include advanced or young age, delayed onset of rash, different seasonality of presentation. But the most important thing to remember is that the highest risk factor is delayed in administration of effective antibiotic therapy. And in this case, we're talking about doxycycline. So I want to also mention some of the other spotted fever rickettsioses in the United States that are known to cause human illness. Besides Rocky Mountain spotted fever caused by Rickettsia rickettsii, we also have Rickettsia parkeri rickettsiosis and Rickettsia species 364D. These rickettsial agents cause acute febrile illness that's similar to Rocky Mountain spotted fever, except that they're often preceded by the appearance of an inoculation eschar, which you can see in the image on the lower right. This inoculation eschar here, I believe, is due to Rickettsia parkeri. So these illnesses are typically less severe than Rocky Mountain spotted fever, but can have similar clinical presentations, including rash and fever. So I'm also going to talk about ehrlichiosis, which is a general name for the members of the Ehrlichia family. In the United States, human ehrlichiosis is most frequently caused by Ehrlichia chaffeensis, but can also be caused by Ehrlichia muris ochlorensis, which was formerly called Ehrlichia muris-like agent, and by Ehrlichia owingii. Again, here you can see the surveillance data that for Ehrlichia chaffeensis, where the majority of our cases occur, and of a little note that those cases in the upper Midwest are likely either cross-reactions with anaplasmosis or Ehrlichia muris ochlorensis and are not likely to be Ehrlichia chaffeensis. The clinical presentation of ehrlichiosis is very similar to Rocky Mountain spotted fever. In the early stages, it's nonspecific with fever, headache, myalgia, malaise. Gastrointestinal symptoms can be prominent. And rash can occur more frequently among children, but is less present in adults. Rash is even less frequently reported in cases of Ehrlichia owingii ehrlichiosis and Ehrlichia muris ochlorensis ehrlichiosis. That's a mouthful. So severe presentations of ehrlichiosis often include multiple system organ failure, shock, respiratory failure, and about 20% of patients have central nervous system involvement, including meningitis. Other ehrlichial species, as I mentioned, include Ehrlichia owingii and Ehrlichia muris ochlorensis. Ochlorensis, which was first case was confirmed in 2011, and these are more emerging infections as we define them better. Last disease I want to cover very quickly is anaplasmosis, which is caused by Anaplasma phagocytophilum here in the United States and is spread by mostly Ixodes scapularis, which is, again, the same vector as Lyme disease and babesiosis. Cases predominantly occur in the upper Midwest and northeastern United States. And the symptoms, as with Rocky Mountain spotted fever and ehrlichiosis, are nonspecific, including fever, headache, and muscle pain. Anaplasmosis is typically less severe than ehrlichiosis and RMSF, but can be severe in some patients, especially those who are immunocompromised and those of advanced age. Severe presentations can include respiratory distress, shock, or neurologic problems. And again, rash is less common in patients with anaplasmosis and may actually be indicative of a co-infection with Lyme disease. The most important thing about rickettsial diseases, tick-borne rickettsial diseases, is that you have a very small window of time because they are rapidly progressing in order to initiate antibiotic therapy. Doxycycline is the most effective antibiotic therapy for the treatment of rickettsial diseases and should be used in patients of all ages. The use of other broad-spectrum antibiotics, especially sulfa derivatives for the treatment of Rocky Mountain spotted fever, may actually be more associated with death. So this study that was done in 2015 or published in 2015, I just want to point out that it contributes to the evidence saying that doxycycline, when used in short courses, meaning about a week, such as those used for the treatment of Rocky Mountain spotted fever, ehrlichiosis, and anaplasmosis, these can be used in patients that are under the age of 8 years. There's historical evidence saying that tetracyclines are contraindicated in children under that age due to the presence of permanent dental staining and enamel hypoplasia. But the study that we did looked at patients who had received doxycycline for the treatment of RMSF before the age of 8, and looking back, we saw no difference in patients who had received doxy and those who hadn't in tooth shade or enamel hypoplasia. So doxy in short courses can be safely used for treatment of Rocky Mountain spotted fever and other rickettsial diseases in children. Due to the lack of sensitive diagnostic assays and the rapid progression of some of the rickettsial diseases, it's most important to keep in mind that when you're making a diagnosis, this is based on your clinical presumption alone, clinical suspicion alone. The diagnostic tests that are available may not be sensitive in acute phases and will likely not help you make a treatment decision. That being said, I do want to go over some of the treatment options that are available for rickettsia. Amplification of rickettsial DNA by PCR is the most specific diagnostic test available, and PCR can be used on whole blood, skin, tissue, CSF, vitreous humor. PCR of whole blood is considered very sensitive for the diagnosis of ehrlichiosis and anaplasmosis because they are associated with the leukocytes in whole blood. However, it's not likely to be a sensitive diagnostic assay for rickettsia rickettsii and other spotted fever group rickettsia because they are not circulating in the whole blood in early stages. However, PCR of skin punch biopsies when there is a rash present or an eschar or the swab of an eschar can be very helpful specimens and can contain a lot of spotted fever rickettsial DNA, which can then be tested by PCR. However, the gold standard really is the indirect immunofluorescence assay for the testing of all rickettsial, tick-borne rickettsial diseases, including rickettsia, ehrlichiosis, and anaplasmosis. And, of course, the correct interpretation really does depend on having the acute phase serum sample, which is collected in the first week of illness, and the convalescent, which is collected 2 to 4 weeks later. And the comparison of those two samples really directs us to a recent infection by rises and falls in antibody titers. Other diagnostic specimens, diagnostic tests could include immunohistochemistry and peripheral blood smears for Ehrlichia and anaplasma. In summary, the rickettsial diseases are difficult to diagnose and really do have the potential to progress very rapidly, which leaves little room for misdiagnosis or not considering Rocky Mountain spotted fever and other rickettsiae in your presumptive diagnosis. So we just want to encourage you to have a low threshold for considering rickettsiae when the symptoms are consistent and the exposure history for tick bites or tick exposures are consistent, and that diagnostic tests should really be used to support a retrospective diagnosis and not for a treatment decision. So I didn't get a lot of time to go into detail, unfortunately, but luckily we have a brand new updated guideline for the treatment and diagnosis of Rocky Mountain spotted fever, other spotted fever group rickettsioses, ehrlichiosis, and anaplasmosis. So if you have any questions, please look to that document, and I think we'll open it up for questions from the group. Thank you.
Thank you, presenters, for providing our COCA audience with such a wealth of information. We'll now open up the lines for the question and answer session. Questions are limited to clinicians who would like information on preventing, recognizing, and managing tick-borne illnesses. For those who have media questions, please contact CDC Media Relations at 404-639-3286 or send an email to media@cdc.gov. If you are a patient, please refer your questions to your healthcare provider. When asking questions, please state your organization. And also remember, you can submit questions through the webinar system as well. Amber, if you could open the phone lines for questions.
Thank you. We'll now begin the question and answer session. If you would like to ask a question, please press star 1. You will be prompted to record your name. Please be sure to unmute your phone. Once again, if you would like to ask a question, please press star 1 in one moment for your first question.
So we have a couple of questions in the webinar system so far. I have one here. What diagnostic tests are able to distinguish between rickettsia, rickettsii, and rickettsia parkeri?
Thank you, Will. This is Naomi, and that's a great question. Because of the cross-reactivity among spotted fever group rickettsioses, antibody tests, including the indirect immunofluorescence assays, can be difficult to distinguish between those two diseases. We do have antigen-specific assays for serology here at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. However, you can also use commercial antibodies to say that there's a positive spotted fever group rickettsiosis. However, another option is also to use PCR. I mentioned that whole blood is not necessarily a sensitive specimen for spotted fever group rickettsial DNA in acute phases of disease. However, if there is a skin biopsy that is present or if there is an eschar, those provide good sources of rickettsial DNA, which we can then type specifically to the antigen.
Thank you. Amber, do we have any questions on the phone line?
We do have a question on the phone line. This question is from Jafar. Please state your organization.
Yeah, hi. This is Jafar from the State Public Health Lab in Connecticut. A question, do you guys have any studies or have you done any work to see if there is any drug resistance to doxycycline for treatment purposes?
This is Naomi. As far as I'm aware, we haven't had any reports of drug resistance to rickettsial diseases. Christina, I don't know if you have any evidence about Lyme disease drug resistance from your experience.
Yeah, we haven't heard reports of that either.
Thank you. We have a question from the webinar system. Based on your statement that doxycycline can be used for short courses in children under 8, would you consider using it for single-dose prophylaxis? If so, what ages and at what doses?
This is Naomi again. So it's important to note, as Christina mentioned, Dr. Nelson mentioned earlier in her presentation, that prophylaxis may be considered in certain circumstances for the treatment, for the preventive treatment of Lyme disease, again, meeting those criteria that she mentioned earlier on, but is not actually recommended for prophylactic treatment of rickettsial diseases. As Christina mentioned, there are studies that show that this may just delay the onset of symptoms and will not actually kill the bacteria or reduce your chances of becoming ill.
Thank you. We have time for about one more question. Are there any questions on the phone line?
Yes, we have a question from Harrison. Your line is open. Please state your organization.
Hello. This is Chris Harrison from Children's Mercy Hospital in Kansas City. We just got a blast email to our group from BioMerius claiming they have a Lyme disease test that will tell you within 27 minutes exactly where it is in the form of disease, is early, mid, late, and that it has a high sensitivity, higher than Western blot. It's a one-step test. Do you guys know anything about that?
Yeah, this is Christina. We have heard of that test. You know, we typically recommend that a test be FDA cleared before we recommend that it be used, because, as you know, FDA clearance is a very rigorous process of evaluating evidence for both sensitivity and specificity and making sure that that test is clinically validated. So it's very interesting, the findings, and we look forward to seeing more published information. And if and when it's FDA cleared, it could possibly be used as a test.
Well, we're already getting requests from our local practitioners of where they're going to get it and how they're going to get it. So I just wanted to make sure I wasn't missing something. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you for the question.
We actually have one more, a little bit more time for one more question. Are there still any questions on the line?
We do have a question from Karen Lopez. Your line is open.
Hi there. This is Karen Lopez from University of Minnesota. I seem to remember reading, perhaps on ProMed, about a rickettsial organism that had been showing up positive. People have been showing up positive on Rocky Mountain spotted fever testing for a rickettsial organism that wasn't, but they weren't showing clinical signs. Does this sound familiar, that people were being treated for Rocky Mountain spotted fever when they didn't actually have it because there was some other organism that was causing like an asymptomatic infection?
Yes, thank you for the question. This is Naomi. There are several other spotted fever group rickettsioses in the United States that are asymptomatic in humans. People don't have any outward symptoms, clinical signs and symptoms of disease, but will express an antibody response to spotted fever antigens. So they will have a positive Rocky Mountain spotted fever test or spotted fever group rickettsiosis antibody test, but may not have clinical symptoms. The diseases I discussed today, the Rickettsia parkeri, Rickettsia 364D, and Rickettsia rickettsii, are all pathogenic, meaning that those persons with those illnesses do express symptoms.
Got it. Thank you.
Thank you, Naomi. On behalf of COCA, I'd like to thank everyone for joining us today, with a special thank you to our presenters, Dr. Nelson, Drexler, and Schiffman. If you have additional questions for today's presenters, please email us at coca@cdc.gov. Put May 24th COCA call in the subject line of your email, and we will ensure that your question is forwarded to the presenter for a response. Again, the email address is coca@cdc.gov. The recording of this call and the transcript will be posted to the COCA website at emergency.cdc.gov/COCA within the next few days. Free continuing education is available for this call. Those who participated in today's COCA conference call would like to receive continuing education should complete the online evaluation by June 23, 2016 using the course code WC2286. For those who will complete the online evaluation between June 24, 2016 and May 24, 2017, use the course code WD2286. All continuing education credits and contact hours for COCA conference calls are issued through the TCE Online and the CDC Training and Continuing Education Online System at www.cdc.gov/TCE Online. To receive information on upcoming COCA calls, subscribe to COCA by visiting the COCA website at emergency.cdc.gov/COCA/subscribe. You can connect with COCA on Facebook. Like our page at Facebook/CDC Clinician Outreach and Communication Activity to stay connected to the latest news from COCA. Thank you again for being a part of today's COCA webinar. Have a great day.
Thank you. That concludes today's conference. Thank you for participating. You may now disconnect.